Hello, welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. My name's Ed Butler. Today, we have the latest dramatic developments from South Korea.
Dear citizens, just a short while ago, the National Assembly demanded the lifting of martial law, and I have ordered the martial law command forces to be withdrawn.
That's the South Korean president announcing that martial law, having been declared, would then be reversed in just 10 hours. What is the latest from that country? Meanwhile, US President Joe Biden is visiting Angola.
Today, millions of African Americans have roots in Angola. Our people lie at the heart of the deep and profound connection that forever binds Africa and the United States together.
President Biden in Luanda, but why is he taking this historic visit to an African country just weeks before concluding his presidency? And marking the enduring popularity of PlayStation. That's what we'll be doing some 30 years after the console's launch. First, though, let's go to the latest from South Korea. It's certainly been all been happening there over the last 6 or 7 hours. Let's begin with how it began, with a late-night televised address in which the president, Yoon Suk-yeol, told the nation he was declaring martial law. It came in response to months of fraught deadlock between the president and the opposition-dominated National Assembly. The move legally included an end to all political activities, to the National Assembly itself, to local councils, political parties and demonstrations. Although tell that to the thousands who immediately gathered outside Parliament to protest the president's move. Abolish martial law, they cried. And that's exactly what Assembly members inside the Parliament building did. They immediately voted overwhelmingly to annul what they called a constitutional coup.
Dear citizens, last night, to start at 11 p.m., I declared martial law with firm resolve to save the nation. However, just a short while ago, the National Assembly demanded the lifting of martial law, and I have ordered the martial law command forces to be withdrawn.
So, as we've heard, the president has now said he will be lifting martial law too, and that the army has been pulled back. Cue wild celebrations among those protesters on the streets. Joining us right now is Rachel Lee. She's from the BBC's Korean service. So, Rachel, we are back where we started with this sequence, very dramatic sequence of events in Seoul. And yet, it does seem like everything has changed there.
Right. So Yoon Suk-yeol, he announced on Wednesday morning, so right after a couple of hours, he announced that he will be lifting martial law in South Korea. And this came after the lawmakers in National Assembly in Seoul unanimously blocked the move. And South Korea president said, as we heard, he will accept the National Assembly's demand and lift martial law through a cabinet meeting. And now all eyes are on whether lawmakers will put forward a bill to impeach President Yoon Suk-yeol as soon as Wednesday.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem that this sequence leaves him in a very perilous position politically. I mean, he tried something very dramatic, a kind of nuclear option, effectively, in calling martial law, something that hasn't been seen in South Korea for decades and decades, and yet now he had to climb down. He looks like a vulnerable figure, doesn't he?
It really is. It really was extreme. It was, some people say it was dramatic. Some people are saying it's even humiliating. Because, you know, the troops, there were troops on the streets, tanks on the streets. So people were seeing just unexpected, and like they're seeing really a rare move of the government. And now the troops have been pulled back from the National Assembly. And they're just, you know, pulling all the troops back. So basically everything is coming back to normal in a couple of hours. So people are, some people are relieved. They're actually celebrating the lifting of the law. And some are saying it's humiliating that the president has done such a thing.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you monitor the mood more widely on South Korean social media. Also, I guess a lot of people may just simply be asleep because it's the middle of the night, or has been for much of the last few hours. But how would you summarize the mood, the sense of mood in the wider country as far as we can gauge it right now?
Right. I mean, it was all happening overnight, but I was getting messages from my friends actually in Korea. They have messaging me over, you know, even though it was late at night, even though it was early in the morning, people were just texting, exchanging pictures of tanks on the streets, and they were frustrated, and some people were just worrying, they're expressing concerns, and some people, in fact, some of my friends would pack emergency kit just in case this situation escalates. So things were quite intense in South Korea for the past, you know, 6 or 7 hours. So people are now relieved that the lifting is now the president announced the lifting.
The BBC's Rachel Lee, thank you very much for joining us. Joining me to discuss the repercussions of all of this on the wider Korean economy, for one thing, is Munsob Lee. He's an assistant professor of economics at the University of California in San Diego. Hi, Munsob Lee. Thank you for joining us. Remind us briefly, if you will, just how this kicked off. I mean, it seemed to start with a long-running argument over the country's budget. Is that right? Between the president and the National Assembly?
I mean, sure. So first of all, thanks for having me. The National Assembly the requested the budget cut. The President Yoon Suk-yeol didn't like it, and then National Assembly also didn't like the President Yoon Suk-yeol's initial budget plan. But I mean, that was only the one out of the several the conflicts the opposition party and President Yoon had. So I don't think the budget was the real issue. If you look at the President Yoon's speech, he mentioned the several other things along with the budget.
Mm. The opposition leader did warn during this crisis in the last few hours that martial law risked causing economic collapse. Strong words from him, given people's deteriorating livelihoods, they could plunge even further, he said. How close do you think we came to anything like that?
I mean, sure. So the financial market responded promptly to the overnight news. So, for example, the Korean won depreciated by approximately 2% at its peak, and the stock prices of the Korean companies listed in the international markets also fell. So now the Korean stock market is set to open in about 1 hour. So then we will see the market's initial reaction. But from my perspective, the event overnight is likely to have a negative impact on the financial market. The effects are expected to be significant, but not catastrophic as the opposition leader described, especially because now the martial law has been lifted.
Mm, but it could yet, as we've heard, lead to an impeachment.
Totally. So the opposition party is likely to pursue the impeachment proceedings against the president, Yoon, and there appears to be significant support for this move. But I mean, Korea experienced the President Park Geun-hye's impeachment only 7 years ago. So in terms of the procedure of the impeachment, the uncertainty is low. But about the outcome of the impeachment, I mean, uncertainty is still there. Yeah, it is going to negatively impact the economy.
We heard of grave concern coming from the White House as all of this was unfolding. South Korea does, of course, sit in a very important geopolitical position, doesn't it? Right next to China, below, of course, North Korea, with the unfolding nuclear risks that seems to pose or is perceived as posing to the United States and others. Do you see this as being something that will, if you like, aggravate the very significant tensions that are there in East Asia right now?
So, the Korea had a strong alliance with the United States. So I expect the impact of this overnight event, or someone may say the happening, is, I think its impact on the geopolitical tension might be limited. But I'm deeply concerned about its implication toward the US-Korea alliance. So while we are waiting further details, it appears that the Yoon administration did not consult in advance with the Biden administration or the United States forced Korea before making this decision. So the President Trump is raising this burden sharing arrangement related to the Korea, the US, the United States, the forced Korea. I think this event, as an outcome of this event, the President Trump may gain the leverage in negotiations, because at least in the short run, I expect that this is going to negatively affect the US-Korea alliance. It's a surprising move.
It might weaken the alliance because what? Because President Trump wants... Just explain more what President Trump might be seeking.
So because this declaration and then cancellation of the martial law was the pure surprise. There is no evidence so far yet, showing that there was consultation or communication in advance with the U.S. government or the U.S. Army in Korean Peninsula, while the South government brought the military force into the power.
Okay, Eunsob Yee, thank you very much indeed for that. Watching the markets for us today is Ayoko Yoshioka, of the Senior Portfolio Manager with Wealth Enhancement Group. Hi, Ayoko. Just quickly, we've heard that obviously it's been a bad time for South Korean assets. We're hoping that they will bounce back. What else has been affecting the markets today?
So far, at least on the U.S. markets, we have seen the news on U.S. steel be impacted in markets, as well as the economic data regarding job openings impact U.S. markets.
Yeah, U.S. steel affected, plunging 8%, because Donald Trump has implied or said very clearly he's going to block the sale to Nippon Steel of Japan for that company, right?
Yes, I think he would like to use, tax incentives and tariffs, his favorite tariffs, to sort of revive, expectations for growth in the company.
The U.S. jobs report, just tell us what we learned.
Sure. So with the jobs report, the job openings for the month of October were actually a little bit higher than we expected. So more potential jobs opening out there. And that could potentially say that the economy is a little bit healthier than we expect. On the other hand, the data could be a little bit noisy because we did have the hurricanes and the Boeing strike impact some of the job data.
Does this feed into sentiment over the latest predicted moves by the Federal Reserve, do you think?
I think it should, but I think the bigger data point will come on Friday when we get the non-farm labor, the payroll numbers.
Ayoko, thank you very much indeed. You are with the World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Now, some of the first African slaves in what's now the United States came from Angola. Almost 4 million Angolans, in fact, were enslaved in the Americas. It was the trafficking of human beings which once brought the US and Angolan economies together. And on Tuesday, President Joe Biden talked about America's original sin, as he put it, when he visited the National Slavery Museum in Angola's capital, Luanda.
Historians believe people from Angola accounted for a significant number of all enslaved people shipped to America. Today, millions of African Americans have roots in Angola. As I said at the U.S. African Leaders Summit that I held in Washington two years ago, our people lie at the heart of a deep and profound connection that forever binds Africa and the United States together. We remember the stolen men and women and children who were brought to our shores in chains, subjected to unimaginable cruelty.
Mr. Biden was speaking there on the first visit of an American president to Africa in almost 10 years. This latest trip to oil-rich Angola is being described as an attempt to counter Chinese investment on the African continent, particularly in the Southern African region. I've been talking about all of that with Precioso Domingos. He's an economist based at the Catholic University of Angola.
Luanda has reason enough to receive the visit of the U.S. president because, according to the International Agency of Energy, by 2040, there will be a surge, let's say a great demand in terms of strategic minerals, mostly used for electric vehicles. Angola has the so-called Lobito Corridor that is a great way for the U.S. to enter in the competition and maybe don't allow that China becomes the leading producer of EV, let's say, in the future.
How far advanced is a deal on an American-backed railway line going through from Angola into the DRC?
Oh, yeah. I think it's a little bit behind. China has been in Africa since some time and had put into place much more investment. We're talking about $20 billion investment against only $3 billion of the EU versus U.S. investment so far. On the top of that, China currently maybe controls at least 72% of the total production of cobalt in Congo, meaning that the EU and the United States have to have a different position, a strategic position, or to have an approach that is different from the one that China has been following.
But what is in it for Angola specifically? Is there a sense of excitement about this visit?
Politically speaking, for the Angolan president, it's a great victory because he can use it as a victory of his own diplomacy. Domestically, things have not going so well for him. And now with this foreign agenda, maybe he comes a little bit strong. But in terms of economics, it is where Angola maybe should to try to work more, because so far there is no more concrete benefits aside just the fact that it is the country that owns the corridor that would be the way out of these strategic minerals. And the fact that also now the United States is here, maybe Angola can also reinforce its position when it comes to negotiating with China, maybe.
Sub-Saharan African countries, ones in southern Africa particularly, should be in a strong position given their mineral wealth.
Definitely, definitely. It will really depend on their own strategy more than, let's say, depending on the possible inflows of dollars that might result from this partnership, from these deals with the United States. Because, as you know, Angola, for example, has a very long history of exploiting oil. Zambia, in turn, diamonds, for example. It is something that has not necessarily resulted in development. I don't see any difference if the approach with different minerals, with different sources of having access to foreign currencies and things like that doesn't be followed necessarily by other policies that have undermined in the past boom in natural resources, mostly oil for Angola.
So you're not holding your breath for anything, any big developments today?
No. Immediately speaking, no.
The Angolan economist, Precioso Domingos. Malaysia Airlines can trace its heritage back to the 1930s. But in modern times, the Malaysian national carrier has been lurching from one crisis to another. Most recently, it has been grappling with safety concerns, the result of an aging fleet, parts shortages, underinvestment. In August, it decided to cut some of its services across Southeast Asia. The man charged with restoring the carrier's fortunes now is Captain Isham Ismail. He's the managing director of Malaysia Airlines Group. He spoke to our business correspondent, Theo Leggett.
The main reason that has contributed to where we are today, Malaysia Airlines, is because of issues on engine reliability, supply chain, and of course, skilled workforce in the region. As you know, the skilled workforce in the Asia-Pacific region is highly demanded. And the spare parts that's coming to us is behind time. We send engines for our overhaul Typically, our contractual obligation with our OEMs is 55 days. We're only getting back our engine 105 days or more. Henceforth, this cannot go on. The cancer has to stop. And that was the decision we made, to cut capacity 20%, ground our planes, take a step back, do what we need to do to ensure that Malaysia Airlines upholds safety. And yes, Teo, because of the historical records of Malaysia Airlines in 2014, of MH370 and 17, Malaysia Airlines cannot wage a wager on safety.
Another problem you have is that your planes are relatively old, and yes, that causes technical problems in itself. You've struggled to get new planes because of issues at Boeing and Airbus.
I would say that Malaysia Airlines today is managing aging fleet. This is because over the last two decades, we have not been investing. Managing aging airplane is a different ballgame. Henceforth, grounding the fleet, taking capacity cut of 20%, taking a step back and re-looking, reviewing the whole entire maintenance exposition that Malaysia Airlines has to take forward. Boeing, delayed delivery of aeroplanes due to circumstances that you and I know went through. But to a certain degree, I have confidence that Boeing will turn around. And as we speak, we have one more 737-8 arriving this week. And Airbus as well. And their delayed aeroplanes are also because of supply chain. So we hope that with the Asia-Pacific growth expected in the next 10 years of 5.6% CAGR, Malaysia Airlines need to be in that position.
Now, you've been in Malaysia Airlines for more than 40 years.
45 years.
You've been leading the company for the past 8 years. Yes. Do you see yourself as part of the future? Are you the right man to take the company forward?
My purpose is to stabilize the organization, lead the organization with clarity of purpose. Two principles. Principle number one, Malaysia Airlines must be part of nation building, Malaysia. Whatever it does, it must be an economic enabler for the country. Number two, it must run commercially. It must stand on its own 2 feet commercially. That's a two principle that I've been very clear with the whole entire organization. Teo, it's not about me. It's about the ambition of my forefathers way back in 1922. It's not about Iza. It's about those ambitions. So my job is to receive that baton and pass it on to someone else. It's not about Islam. It's about the purpose.
Business leader and it seems nation builder, Captain Ijam Ismail of Malaysia Airlines Group, speaking to the BBC's Theo Leggett. Now, tell me, how does this sound make you feel? Well, depending on how long you've been playing, that may take you back. It has, in fact, been 30 years since the PlayStation theme was first played as the console hit the shelves in Japan for the first time. Since then, there have been 5 versions of the PlayStation console, with millions and millions of us chipping in with our hard-earned savings to grab one. Bree Fowler, a senior technology writer for CNET, the US tech publication, is with me to mark the moment. Bree, tell us about the longevity of the PlayStation console. And given how fast everything moves in tech, are you surprised that we're still talking about the same thing?
You know, not really, because these consoles have been around for a long time. And it's not just them, Nintendo, other companies as well. You know, these
Xbox,
things have staying power. Yeah. I mean, people keep buying them. They get the updated version and they just keep going.
Is it about the hardware itself then, or is it about the longevity? Is it about Sony's capacity to channel the best games, the best software that feeds this device that we all seem to love?
I mean, probably all of that. I mean, you think about gaming and how much it's changed since I was a kid in the 80s, and you had these, you know, little pixelated games with not much in the way of graphics or plot. Now gaming it's theatrical. You have actors, you have, you know, people that are digitally rendered, but they look very, very real and speak, and it's an immersive experience.
An immersive one and an emotional one. Yeah, I don't know how much of a gamer you are, but do you ever cry during a game these days?
I have to admit, I am not much of a gamer. I have younger kids, so they have a Nintendo Switch. So it doesn't quite compare to what you'd see on a PlayStation when it comes to those, you know, world building and immersion games. You know, and this is why that some of those games get turned into TV and movies, because they already have that plot and that emotional connection built in.
With so many other things not going very well for Sony, I guess, as an international kind of, you know, tech firm, mm-hmm. the PlayStation has held it together, I guess, for a large part of the last three decades.
Yeah, definitely.
How much... I saw that the joint CEOs, Herman Hulston and Hideaki Nishino, spoke to the BBC this week, and they mm-hmm. said, you know, that tech and indeed AI will never replace the individual human touch that makes PlayStation games so enduring.
I think that in some ways it definitely won't, but AI has stepped in. You see this used in any kind of software and hardware development. AI can be used to do that grunt work, the low end coding that, you know, people just hate to do because it's so tedious. And that does replace coders and people to a certain extent.
But you still see the PlayStation staying with us for some time to come.
Oh, absolutely. This is not going away anytime soon, AI or not.
Bree Fowler, senior technology writer for CNET. Thank you very much indeed. And that winds up this edition of World Business Report. I'm Ed Butler from me and the rest of the team. Thanks for listening.